From MainePublic.org, I'm Barbara Caridi, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Monday, November 28, 2016. And on this day, following the death of a transgender teen at the Long Creek Youth Development Center, Maine's corrections chief says it might be time to consider creating a state psychiatric facility for mentally ill youth. Governor Paul LePage says he'll ask the next legislature to make changes in two ballot initiatives voters endorsed on Election Day, but some legislative leaders are balking. And Maine educators want to know why new programs intended to smooth students' transition from high school to college are not producing more college graduates. Those stories and more after this.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners and by Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens, presenting Gardens Aglow, where visitors will see the gardens in a whole new light, now through December 31st, MaineGardens.org, and USM's Muskie School of Public Service Master of Public Health Program, preparing students for today's complex population health and health services needs.
I'm Barbara Caridi. Maine Corrections Commissioner Joseph Fitzpatrick will convene a panel of experts in Maine this week to review suicide prevention and LGBT policies at the Long Creek Youth Development Center. The meeting follows the recent suicide of a transgender teen at the facility, the first death of a child in state custody in more than 20 years. Dr. Fitzpatrick says he's open to any and all suggestions. And as Susan Sharon reports, the commissioner says it might also be time to consider creating a state psychiatric facility for mentally ill youth.
As the Maine Attorney General's Office and state police continue their investigation into the suicide of 16-year-old Mays Knowles, Dr. Fitzpatrick says he wants to know what, if anything, Long Creek can do better. Knowles had been held at Long Creek since August after setting fire to his house. He had a long history of mental illness, but because he had not been sentenced in court, he had not been committed to the facility. Instead, he was what's known as a temporary detainee. And Mays's mother, Michelle Knowles, believes that's why he was not getting a full range of mental health treatment at Long Creek. Because of the pending investigation, Fitzpatrick declined to discuss the Knowles case, but he says, in general, there's no difference in the way kids receive treatment.
In terms of medical and mental health care, there isn't a large difference between the detainee and the committed population. Any child that enters Long Creek is assessed within hours of their admission, whether they're there as a detention resident or a committed resident. And then from that point forward, any needs that are identified are addressed.
For example, if a detainee has mental health counseling needs or has been prescribed psychiatric medication, Fitzpatrick says that will be continued. And if a mental health or medical need arises during confinement, Fitzpatrick says that will also be addressed. The only difference for detainees and committed residents is the kind of correctional programming each gets because of a detainee's uncertain and more limited length of stay.
The challenging part about programming for detainees is we are not in charge of how long they're going to be there. So they could come in and they could be there for 2 days, they could be there for 2 months. It's very hard to do correctional programming, which is long-term programming.
What's also challenging, says Fitzpatrick, is the complexity of mental health needs that youth are presenting at Long Creek.
What is actually escalating is the need level, the acuity of the illness that these kids are coming in with. And it just goes beyond the resources of a juvenile justice facility. Some individuals, some youth who have significant trauma histories and mental health histories and are potentially suicidal or dangerous on some level do not have secure places to go, secure treatment facilities to go.
Fitzpatrick says the Department of Health and Human Services does a good job trying to secure community placements for kids where appropriate, such as crisis beds and private hospitals. But he says the reality is that those private facilities have the right to turn down juveniles, especially older kids, who they think pose a safety risk to property or to staff.
So Long Creek becomes sort of a holding facility for children who might really have needs that go well beyond the resources of a Long Creek. We work closely with DHS, and DHS is actually has a presence in the Long Creek facility, but we're really, as a state, struggling with that piece and trying to figure out a better answer to that need for these kids.
For adults with serious mental illness, there is the state-run Riverview Psychiatric Center, but there is nothing equivalent in Maine for juveniles. Fitzpatrick says it's an idea that has been floated before, but now it could take on more significance.
We'd be certainly willing to work, and we work closely with DHS on the concept of, gee, what would that look like? It wouldn't be an adult facility. It would be obviously specializing in youth and juveniles, and how could we make it secure and therapeutic at the same point?
A psychologist himself, Fitzpatrick says he has tried to infuse mental health treatment into everything connected to the Department of Corrections. He says he's confident in his staff training and department protocols, but remains open to doing anything that can improve the juvenile corrections system in Maine. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Susan Sharon.
Meanwhile, a battle is brewing in the next legislative session over two initiatives that Maine voters approved on November 8th. Governor Paul LePage was a vocal opponent of Question 2, which would generate funding for public schools through a surtax on high-income households, and Question 4, which raises the state's minimum wage. He continues to argue that both will hurt the economy, and he's asking the next legislature to make changes in the laws. But as Mal Leary reports, some leaders in Augusta say they're reluctant to second-guess the will of the voters.
Mainers approved the minimum wage bill by a solid margin, but LePage believes it will hurt the economy by forcing small businesses to cut jobs. He is particularly worried that the cost will be passed on to consumers, including seniors, in the form of higher prices.
The minimum wage bill is going to really put about 325,000 seniors in severe poverty. I'm going to do everything in my power to try to mitigate that and try to help them.
In a letter to lawmakers, LePage proposes that the increase in the minimum wage be phased in over a longer time and that automatic future increases be removed. He also asks that lawmakers restore a lower minimum wage for workers who receive tips.
It was pretty widely discussed here in the building with folks on both sides of the aisle decrying the fact that it was going to do away with the tip credit.
Senate President Mike Thibodeau and other Republican leaders say the initiatives can be modified if necessary. They point to changes that will have to be made due to flaws in the drafting of the recreational marijuana measure, for example. But Democrats are wary of doing anything significant to change the minimum wage proposal.
Of all the questions that passed, that's the one that passed with the largest margin, about 55%. It was a pretty strong vote.
Lewiston Democrat Jared Golden is the Assistant House Majority Leader. He says that while he's willing to consider making changes, the will of the voters needs to be respected.
I think people spoke clearly. I'm not someone that ever walks into an issue saying, I'm not going to listen.
Incoming State Senator Troy Jackson, a Democrat from Allegash, will serve as Minority Leader. He says Democrats will be reluctant to make changes even to the controversial tip credit portion of the minimum wage law.
Many people in the state may feel like that's not something that should be in there, but that was what was voted on by the people in the state of Maine. And win or lose, you have to honor the people's vote.
In his letter to lawmakers, LePage also mentions other initiatives aimed at easing the burden he says will be caused by the passage of the minimum wage increase. He wants to remove the income tax from pensions, reduce the cost of medications for seniors, and make it more difficult for lenders to foreclose on elderly homeowners. As for Question 2, which creates a fund for public schools through a surcharge on wealthier households, LePage says he would not propose changing the surtax itself, but instead present a major tax reform package that will reduce the regular top income tax rate on which the surcharge is assessed, which now stands at 7.15%.
The tax increase is about a surcharge. I have no choice. I'm going to have to put a surcharge on. But the 7.15% that I have something to say about, there's no restrictions on that. The only thing that this referendum did said we have to add a 3% surcharge.
The governor says his target is a top rate of 5.75%, which would come with a price tag of tens of millions of dollars. Incoming House Speaker Sarah Gideon, a Democrat from Freeport, says Democrats will take a good look at the governor's budget proposal.
I and Democrats in general remain committed to the idea of funding education, which is what question two was about, which I think he's trying to get at. Number one, we also believe in a progressive tax structure.
On the Republican side, Senate President Mike Thibodeau says his caucus will not support any tax reform effort that simply shifts the burden around.
Shifting taxes creates winners and losers every time. If we can find a way to reduce the tax burden, that's great. But, if we're just shifting taxes for the sake of redistributing, then I don't see the panacea in that.
The status of question two, meanwhile, is still up in the air. It passed by a very narrow margin and is now undergoing a recount. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
And the State Ethics Commission wants to tighten up Maine rules for publicly funded candidates. Under the proposal, candidates who receive Maine clean election funds would no longer be able to make cash payments of more than $50. The commission wants to make candidates ineligible for public funding if they fail to make sure their campaigns don't collect fraudulent contributions. The commission is also proposing that to avoid fraud and mistakes, candidates would no longer be able to compensate people based on how many contributions they collected. A hearing on the proposed rules is scheduled for December 8th. And a new class action lawsuit claims that an electric company deceived Maine consumers and bilked them out of $35 million. A lawsuit filed in U.S. District Court in Portland November 18th claims that Electricity Maine used fraud and deception to enroll 200,000 Maine households and small businesses with the promise of substantial cost savings. But attorney Benjamin Donahue says after a certain amount of time, consumers' rates went up to more than the standard offer, and they weren't given the advance written notice they were legally required to get.
They would send notice by email, and our investigation has revealed that Electricity Maine was aware that its email notices were going to people's spam inboxes, and people were re-enrolled at rates that were much higher than the promotional rates that they had signed up for.
Two Maine residents are seeking damages to recover the $35 million. Donahue says he's received calls from dozens more ratepayers since filing the lawsuit. A representative for the parent company of Electricity Maine said the company doesn't comment on pending litigation. Coming up, programs designed to help Maine students transition to college aren't producing the intended results, and educators want to know why. New details are emerging in a shootout in Cumberland County over the weekend that left two men dead and another critically injured. Fred Bever has more.
Authorities say events began late Saturday night when 59-year-old Norman Strobel of Naples and a companion arrived at a Casco camp belonging to Strobel's ex-girlfriend, who had won a protection from abuse order against him. She wasn't there, but when her daughter and another man appeared at a window, authorities say Strobel opened fire with a 9mm handgun. Several bullets hit the man inside the camp, authorities say, injuring him critically. County Sheriff Kevin Joyce says Strobel fled the scene and later called his ex-girlfriend, admitting involvement with the Casco shooting. Strobel's cell phone signal led six deputy sheriffs to a mobile home in Naples at around 4 a.m.
While looking into the window, they observed a male subject sitting in a chair with blood on his face. The deputies entered the residence in an attempt to provide aid to the male subject. As they entered the residence and identified themselves as police officers, Mr. Strobel appeared with a gun in his hand.
A firefight broke out and Strobel was killed. The man in the chair, meanwhile, Richard Dickema, 55, was dead. State police say they believe he had accompanied Strobel at the first scene and fled to Naples with him, where Strobel then shot him. But investigators are still piecing together the details of the shootings, including the possible motives. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
And an entrepreneur and developer with Maine ties has pleaded guilty in federal court to making illegal campaign contributions in the run-up to the 2012 U.S. presidential election. Assistant U.S. Attorney Donald Clark says that 56-year-old Michael Liberty of Windermere, Florida, has admitted to illegally making political contributions in the names of others to an unnamed presidential candidate's primary campaign committee.
According to admissions that he made in connection with his guilty plea between May and June of 2011, Mr. Liberty made $22,500 in primary contributions through nine employees, associates, and family members.
Clark says Liberty actually paid for all of the contributions himself. Liberty faces up to 2 years in prison and a $250,000 fine. Clark says a sentencing date has not yet been set, but he says typically sentencing would take place in 2 to 3 months. And with college trips, applications, and financial aid deadlines approaching, the next few weeks will be stressful for many of Maine's high school seniors. New partnerships between high schools and colleges are being designed to make that post-secondary transition easier. But as Robbie Feinberg reports, the new programs aren't producing more college graduates, and educators are searching for the reasons why.
So here we get to write as much as we want. And then
Lewiston High School senior Halima Aiden is the kind of student that you think might face a lot of obstacles on the way to college. She came to the United States from Somalia as a child, and even now, college seems foreign to her family.
Well, my parents didn't speak English, so when they don't really know the concepts of college, so when you tell them college, they just think like it's a step up from high school. They don't know that you pay for college, you live in the dorm, so it was kind of hard to explain to them.
And yet, despite still being a high schooler, Aiden is already in college. 3 days a week, she takes an online class on early childhood education through a partnership between Lewiston High School and Central Maine Community College. Last year, she even headed to the CMCC campus in person to take a college-level sociology class.
It was terrifying. You're like the little kid in a high school classroom. If I'm scared to say something that might not sound sophisticated or articulate, and I don't want to come off as this dumb kid. So like you get scared, but then eventually after a while you get used to your classmates and you learn some of them and they're like really nice.
Aiden is one of a growing number of students in early college and dual enrollment programs in Maine. These are partnerships between high schools and local colleges designed so students can receive college credit and get some exposure to the new environment while still having the support of a high school around them. Doug Dumont is the aspirations coordinator at Lewiston High School.
It allows the students to see what college is like. Because a lot of students say, there's no way I can take a college-level class. And then when they see that, yes, it's a lot of work, but it's really no different than a higher or upper-level high school class.
These programs have exploded over the past few years. As just one example, the University of Maine at Fort Kent now enrolls more than 700 high school students in its Rural U program. And it's been embraced by schools like Maranacook Community High School in Redfield. At Maranacook, nearly half of the students are enrolled in a college course through a partnership with Thomas College. Assistant Principal Kristen Levesque emphasizes that the classes aren't designed for high achievers. Many are for those at risk.
It's an early intervention to help them graduate from high school. A kid can say that they, when they're 14, 15 years old, they took a summer class and got an A in college, then they can get through high school. I think it definitely is a form of dropout prevention.
The results so far are promising. The number of Maine high schoolers enrolling in college is going up every year. And Maranacook in particular has seen its graduation rate go from 80% in 2013 to 90% in 2015. But there's a rub.
We hear often that they help get their students to college, but then, you know, a semester, two semesters, three semesters later, they see them and they're back in town, and too often they're working at the same job they had when they were in high school.
Wendy Ault is the executive director of the Melmac Education Foundation, which gives money to schools to help students reach college. While more students may be enrolling in college in Maine, almost half aren't finishing within 6 years. The numbers are far worse in rural places like Washington County, where less than 40% of students who entered college in 2007 actually finished. Researcher Lisa Plimpton views this as a financial problem. She says the number of low-income students going to college in Maine has nearly doubled over the last 8 years. But those new college students don't have a large safety net to fall back on.
Then any kind of like a financial emergency or unexpected expense can knock people out of college, even when they've got 2 or 3 years under their belt.
So how do you help a student both financially and academically? Alt with the Melmac Foundation says her organization is trying a new approach. It's now giving high schools the resources to help them stay in contact with students after they've already gone off to college. The idea is to use existing relationships to help students in their new environment.
In a perfect world, it would be a nice handoff from the high school to the college, but that's not what we're observing while kids are young in their college experience. They still look back to high school.
For Halima Aiden, the Lewiston High School senior, she says early college classes have shown her that she is ready for life after high school.
It doesn't really scare me as much, and I'm like ready for it because it's like any other classroom I've been into because I already took the class. So if it's an online class or if it's an on-campus class, it won't faze me because I already tried it.
And Aiden says it makes her comfortable knowing she does have support along the way, not just from the school, but from a local lawyer who serves as a mentor. Few low-income students have that sort of resource, but educators say this one-on-one lasting support may be the key to getting students into college and helping them graduate. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Robbie Feinberg.
And computer giant Apple and the Conservation Fund are donating a 32,400-acre conservation easement to Forest Society of Maine. The Reed Forest land is located in Aroostook County in northern Maine. Apple is also supporting the Conservation Fund's donation of an endowment to the Forest Society that the Society says will ensure that the easement is monitored and enforced. Apple and the Conservation Fund partnered to protect the land last year. Alan Hutchinson, executive director of the Forest Society, says the easement ensures the land will remain available to Mainers who want to pursue traditional outdoor activities.
That's one of the beauties of these conservation easements, that this one in particular, but the ones that we like to work on, is that they keep the lands open and available for the traditional recreational uses, hunting, fishing, hiking, camping, just the whole array of things that go on up there right now.
The Forest Society says protecting Maine's forests is important because they provide habitat for species such as Atlantic salmon, bald eagle, and Canada lynx. And as the world reacts to the death of Fidel Castro, not many Mainers can say they met the longtime Cuban leader. But those who did, while on an agricultural trade mission in 2005, will never forget it. Former Governor John Baldacci said Castro, who was 80 at the time, wore his gym clothes to a last-minute meeting and proved he was well-versed on agriculture by talking about artificial insemination in cattle. Baldacci described the discussion as being akin to a scene from Saturday Night Live. He said he had mixed emotions about meeting Castro, but it was good for business. The Maine delegation won a deal to sell farm goods to Cuba. Castro died Friday at age 90. And finally, here's meteorologist Paul Cousins with the forecast.
For once, a seasonably cold night will befall the state. Skies will be starlit for all. Temperatures drop to the teens north and mountains to mid-20s along the coast. Northern Maine is slated for shipments of snow for the rest of the week. The first storm will deliver rain to coastal Maine, commencing as freezing rain interior southwest, snow western Maine, evolving to a mix then rain. Highs tomorrow 31 to 44 north to south. The storm will continue into the night with a coating of snow from Bethel to Lincoln to as much as 4 to 8 inches Presque Isle north. The snow will end across northern Maine early Wednesday. Look for limited sunshine early throughout the rest of the state once the fog dissipates, with rain returning late in the afternoon as the second storm advances. Wide temperature spread, freezing north, upper 40s south. Snow will taper to flurries over northern and western Maine Thursday as winds shift to the west. Yet drying will be limited to the coastal plain, where skies will be partly sunny, balmy, and breezy, 33 to 54 north to south. Mild air remains Friday, with snow showers in the mountains and far north. This is meteorologist Paul Cousins for Maine Public.
And that's the news on this day in Maine, Monday, November 28th, 2016. Robert Holt composed our theme music. Thanks to our news leaders, Keith Shortall, Susan Sharon, and Andrew Catalina, and to Mal Leary, Fred Bever, Robbie Feinberg, A.J. Higgins, Ed Morin, and Nora Flaherty for their contributions. We'd like to hear your thoughts on the podcast. You can rate and comment in iTunes, or you can email us at tdim@mainepublic.org. I'm Barbara Caridi. For all of us here at Maine Public, thanks for listening.